Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. This is Michael Stone. You're listening to Conversations. Coming up, a two-hour special with Derek Jensen. Derek is an American author, philosopher, environmental activist. He is a leading voice of cultural dissent and explores the nature of injustice, how civilizations devastate the natural world, and how human beings retreat into denial at the destruction of the planet. His work examines the central question: if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, then why are we doing it? Jensen co-authors Deep Green Resistance, and also the book we're going to be talking about today, Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. Derek, welcome to Conversations. Can you hear me, Derek?
Yeah, I said thank you for having me.
Oh, great, great. Sorry. It's crazy bored here. Yeah, it's really good. I'm sorry Lierre couldn't make it. For those of you listening, we will have her on at a later time. She lost her voice. That's a tough thing for an activist to lose their voice. But luckily we've got Derek, and I'd like to start talking about the dominant culture and how it's killing the planet. You know, how is this happening and why aren't we stopping it? It seems like no matter what we do in the environmental community, that the devastation continues to expand and grow.
Well, so do you want to talk about, what angle do you want to come at that?
That's a big question. Well, first of all, how is it? Because I don't think people have a full, not all of our listeners fully understand the concept of dominant culture. So let's talk there. What is the dominant culture?
Well, once again, we can break that into a bunch of different directions too, that you could say that the dominant culture is civilization, and then we can talk about what that is. We could say that the dominant culture really is patriarchy. We can say that the dominant culture is based on human supremacism, which is the notion that humans are superior to everybody else. We can talk about patriarchy. You know, we can talk about any of those, really. I guess one way to talk about it would be to, look at, they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. Well, let's lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of Iraq, is the first thing that you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, well, that's what is now Iraq was prior to the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of the dominant culture was Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make great cities.
Right.
And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna, and the Near East was heavily forested. You remember reading about the cedars of
the Fertile
of Lebanon.
Crescent, yeah, the whole area.
Yeah, it was heavily forested, and Greece was heavily forested, and the some of the big three, I don't remember which ones, it was Plato, Aristotle, and I always forget the third one out there. Anyway, three of those old dead guys, they were complaining that deforestation was harming water quality in Greece. And I'm sure that the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them they have to, you know, study that for a few years and make sure that there really is a correlation, and which, of course, is what's happening today. And North Africa was heavily forested, and those forests went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. And so basically, forests precede this culture, and deserts dog its heels. There were whales in the Mediterranean. There's this thing called overshoot, which is, it is possible, well, let's think back up a little bit, there's this thing called carrying capacity, which is how many of a certain creature can live in a certain place permanently. So you can have an island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer, and 1,000 deer could live there forever, and their poop is nourishing the soil, and the plants are nourishing them, and basically, and then they're also nourishing the mountain lions, and everybody's happy. And let's say you put 10,000 deer on that island. They're going to eat too much. They're going to poop too much. Their hooves are going to tear up the soil, and they will permanently reduce carrying capacity. Well, you can reduce carrying capacity not only by eating and pooping, but you can also do it by deforesting, by turning the forest into navies. And one of the problems is that once a culture has begun to overshoot, two things are going to be really inevitable. One of them is that it's either going to keep expanding because it's overshot its carrying capacity, which means that the land will reduce, will lose its capacity to support them, or it will collapse. And sometimes civilizations have chosen to collapse. We don't know why the Mayan civilization ended. A lot of people think that they began to walk away, and the same with the mound builders. But other times, as in the Near East, they've continued to expand and expand. And what that means, expansion, means that you have to take somebody else's land. And one of the disadvantages is, if you choose to overshoot your carrying capacity and to destroy your land base so that you can make better weapons of war, so you can conquer better, you're going to have a competitive advantage over your neighbors. And that's one of the reasons that the dominant culture has been able to overspread the planet, is because they've been converting land bases into weapons of war, and continue to this day, of course, as opposed to planning on living there. Where I live right now is on Talawa land, Talawa Indian, and the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years. And they didn't conquer their neighbors. They would have squabbles, of course, and they would fight, and they would get along, and then they would fight, whatever. They're just like everybody else. But they didn't conquer, and they lived near the Yuroks and the Wiyots for more than 10,000 years, if you believe in science, and if you believe in the myths of the Talawa, they lived just in the beginning of time. But the point is, they lived here a really long time, and they didn't conquer. And that's an entirely different way to live on the planet. And it's not just the Talawa. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of indigenous cultures across the planet that were living sustainably. There still are some, but many have been conquered. And so when I talk about the dominant culture, I talk about this way of life that has really overspread the planet, that is based on the notions of that humans are superior to everyone else, that non-humans are resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with, other beings whose lives are just as valuable to them. I'm talking about plants and rocks and everybody else too, not just chimpanzees. And
well, that's one of the key issues when you're talking about overshoot and you're talking about an expanding deer population, then nature has a way of just the deer die off and other species, fill in, and then it comes back into balance. But in the case of humans, we're taking 200 species a day along with us.
Yeah, and I don't really know what to say to that. It's absolutely true, and it breaks my heart every day. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that breaks my heart is the extraordinary level of denial about all of this, that even among a lot of environmentalists, I'm not really talking about grassroots activists, I'm talking more about sort of ecological or environmental intelligentsia or national environmentalists. But once again, the grassroots activists I've known have usually understood this, but the more mainstream ones don't. And the thing I'm getting at is that, like, for example, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming that are presented by mainstream environmentalists, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And there's just so many extraordinary quotes about this. Like right after Fukushima, this wasn't an environmentalist, this was a Japanese minister of energy, said that, of course, they have to continue with nuclear power because, quote, we cannot imagine living without electricity. And that's quite an extraordinary statement because, I mean, right now, the majority of humans on the planet don't really have access to electricity. And humans have lived quite well without electricity for all of our existence. And it is the people in the elite, which includes you and me, the global elite, are the ones who can't imagine without electricity. And the world cannot support the industrial generation of electricity. It's not sustainable. And back to the global warming question, the question of wanting to preserve capitalism, I mean, it's like Lester Brown has, you know, plan 7.0 point B to save civilization. I mean, let's go back to the Japanese Minister of Energy and imagine saying, instead of, we can't imagine living without electricity, imagine him saying, we can't imagine living without ice caps, or we can't imagine living without polar bears, or we can't imagine living without passenger pigeons, even though we have to live without them. We can't imagine living without salmon. We can't imagine living without oceans. You know, I read this interesting and horrifying figure the other day. I knew for a long time that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. I knew that. But what I didn't know is, I read this maybe a month ago, that if you weighed all the fish in the oceans in, I think it was 1840 or might have been 1870, and then you weighed them now, they would weigh 10%. The total mass of fish in the oceans would be about 10% what it was 150 years ago.
Wow.
And, you know, I do columns for Orion, and either the next column or the column after that I'm going to write, so it's going to be, you know, published 6 or 8 months from now, is going to be from this great line that I read years and years ago by John Livingston, which is, there is no surplus in nature. And every fish that you pull out of the ocean is a fish that someone else doesn't get to eat. I mean, economists, I took graduate-level economics after college. I took the coursework for a degree in graduate economics, and then I bailed out on doing the thesis. Anyway, the first thing they said in any of my economics course, the very first thing in my first economics course, was to say, there is no free lunch. And everybody, all the economists understand this, that there is no free lunch, that if I choose to go to lunch, that means that I'm choosing to not do something else. I could be sleeping. I could be talking to you on the phone. So everything you do has what they call an opportunity cost. But so this is like rule number one of economics, except suddenly when it comes to the natural world, they forget that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how can they say that and then talk about continuous growth on a planet with finite resources? That doesn't fit into that. Unless you don't take into account all other life.
Well, yes, yeah, and also this is all presuming that this actually is sane. I mean, what you're saying makes sense in a sane world, but that's part of the problem too, is that the problems we face aren't fundamentally rational. Two things I want to say. One is that there's this great line by Upton Sinclair, and sorry about the sexism, we can change that. He says, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it.
Yeah.
And I would switch that a little bit to, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it. And, well, we'll go to the other direction in just a second. But before then, there's, you know, I was thinking about this. It's extraordinary how quickly we become, okay, I'm going to say this in a value-neutral sense. It's extraordinary how quickly pieces of technology can become entirely embedded in our lives, such that, like the Japanese minister said, we can't hardly imagine living without them. I was thinking about this yesterday, because humans have only had cars for 3 generations, and cars are completely overrunning the planet. And this is in industrial areas. And, of course, 1 generation ago, a friend of mine was just visiting from India, and we were talking about this, and she said that when she was growing up, that they didn't have cars for the most part. Most people had cars. It was a scooter culture, motorized scooters. And how quickly, it's only 1 generation there, and cars have completely taken over. And I was thinking about this in terms of, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
67.
Okay, so you grew up even before I. I was one of the first people I knew to have a computer, and that was in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when my friend George Drafin told me about this thing called email in the early 90s. And so the point is, I'm 52, so I was 31 before I even heard of email. And now, of course, it's within industrialized peoples, it's completely normalized.
It's an addiction, actually.
Yes. I completely agree. And I was avoiding that word because I was attempting to remain value neutral for a moment.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
But yeah, I completely agree. Sorry. I got to stop and check email. Hold on. I'll be right back.
Right.
Yeah. And so the point is that these things, and I keep thinking also, I was going to apologize for jumping subject to subject, but if you know my work, then you know this is what you're going to get with me.
And I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
We'll all bring it back together.
Yeah. It also makes me think of a line by one of the name of one of the Doobie Brothers albums, which is what were once vices are now habits.
Yeah.
And it just is extraordinary to me that, I saw this, somebody posted me something a month ago that said in 2012, these two went extinct, and which did you care about? And one was, I believe it was an Eastern mountain lion or a Florida mountain lion, and the other one was a Twinkie. And you remember the big brouhaha that came out over the Hostess stopping making Twinkies.
Right.
And at the same time, as you said earlier, 200 species went extinct, and nobody, for the most part, people don't care. And so I guess that's going to take to the second thing. Well, I want to go back to the point I started to make earlier and never finished about so many mainstream environmentalists. They say explicitly they want to protect industrial civilization and not the planet, and that their solutions to global warming take industrial civilization as a given, and that takes us from rationality to non-rationality, or reasonableness to non-reasonableness, because that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with the physical world, because without a real physical world, you don't have a social system, which means any social system you have must be dependent upon the physical world. And it is a measure of the insanity of our culture that I even have to say that, because instead of saying, I can't imagine living without electricity, or people can't imagine living without electricity, or people can't imagine living without polar bears, imagine saying, people can't imagine living without clean air or clean water,
mm-hmm.
which we don't really have to imagine at this point, of course. I mean, for crying out loud, this is something that's been quite extraordinary, this is the level to which people are addicted to. Now we can go ahead and shift to non-normalized words. People are completely addicted to this way of life, is that they're not merely harming others, but at this point, fracking is just an extraordinary thing, because they're fracking their own water supplies.
It's amazing. And how people, a real example of what you're talking about is how people are fighting to be able to have their properties fracked where it's trying to be made illegal. And this takes me back to where I wanted to start here about the dominant culture killing the planet, and how can that happen? And many conversations that we've had and things that you've written talk about how we in the environmental movement, and I've been involved in the environmental movement since the 70s, are trying to make change within a system that there's no possibility of making change when a culture, what I call a corporatocracy, the corporations, the banks, and the governments together, you can't fight the power elite who owns the money, the media. They're armed and dangerous. They wrote the laws. They have no environmental consciousness. So we're operating within a system trying to make something happen inside of a system which is flawed and fundamentally broken.
Have we talked before about Robert J. Lifton and the Nazi doctors?
Yeah. Oh, well, we haven't talked, but I've read what you've written about them.
Okay. Can I talk about that for a second?
Absolutely.
Because we've never talked before. I thought we did an interview before.
We've had several interviews. We just haven't talked about Lifton.
Okay, great.
That's all.
Yeah, I was thinking. my memory is going, but I remembered us talking.
No, we've talked a number of times.
Good, good.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking alternate universe.
And Lear, too.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the most important books I ever read was by Robert J. Lifton, and it was called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he asked the question, how was it that men, they're men, not, this is not sexist, they actually were men, how is it that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could work in Nazi death camps? And what he found was really interesting was that, leaving aside people like Mengele, he just talked about them too, you know, just outright sadists, leave them aside. Most of the doctors who worked in the Nazi death camps were actually very, they cared very deeply for the health of the inmates. And they would do everything they could to keep the inmates safe and healthy, or as least unhealthy as possible. And so they would give them an extra scrap of potato, or they would hide them from the selection officers who were going to kill them, or they would, if they got sick, sometimes they would let them off work for a couple days, or if they got typhus, they might actually kill that patient to save others. And, you know, they were trying to save others from getting that contagious disease. And the point that he made is that they did everything in their power to help the inmates, except for the most important thing of all, which is they didn't question the existence of the death camp itself.
And the system.
And the system itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the systematic racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, they didn't question any of the larger system at all. And that's one of the reasons I think that environmentalists keep losing in general, is because so many of us are acting like the Nazi doctors in that, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I just mean it, once again, normatively, that most of us are doing everything we can to help this or that creature we love, or this or that piece of land that we love. Everything except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the entire culture that is working the planet to death, that's starving the planet to death, that's gassing the planet to death. And so we're really analogous to the Nazi doctors in not asking those larger questions and not questioning the larger framework. You know, for crying out loud, one of the things I do all winter, I have to cough, hold on. Excuse me. One of the things I do all winter and spring is the frogs are dying in a pond right next to my house. And so I go out and bring in tadpole egg sacs, frog egg sacs, to raise on my kitchen table, because they're dying because of depletion of the ozone layer, because extra UVB gets through, which weakens some egg sacs, and then there's a ubiquitous mold called Sapolegnia. It's not the mold's fault. The mold's job is to take out the weak egg sacs, just, you know, eating the weaker ones. But the problem is that with the UVB layer, I mean, with the ozone layer depleted, UVB comes down, weakens the egg sacs, and so if I bring them inside, I have like 100% success rate on them living, because the UVB can't get through glass. And if they stay in the pond, there's like a probably 25% success rate. And so this is wonderful for these particular frogs, but, you know, obviously this is completely incommensurate with the collapse of frog populations worldwide. And my point is that so many of us do this, or we, you know, stop this or that timber sale, or we, you know, try to stop this or that horrible thing from going in. And that's all really, really important work to do. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but at the same time, it's not questioning the larger death camp culture.
And I remember you also mentioning, I think it was this, to one of the one of the political functions of the local EPA or whatever it is, and how they told you you had to get a permit or get permission to bring those inside your house. Wasn't that what part of the story also?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty funny. So I didn't know what I was doing at first, and so I wanted to find out what's going on, and then I wanted to find out if there's, like, better ways to bring frog eggs in or worse ways or whatever. And so I called this guy at U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and he was actually very helpful. He was great. But then I called somebody at California Department of Fish and Game.
Fish and Game, yeah.
Yeah, and it was extraordinary. she tells me to cease and desist. She says, you can't bring in frogs without a permit. That's terrible. And I said, okay, great. So how do I get a permit? And she said, there is no process. And, okay, that would be fine. I don't have a problem with them stopping people from bringing frogs in because you want to cook them or something, you know, whatever. But the problem is that California Department of Fish and Game is the same department that routinely signs off on massive clear cuts, or that routinely signs off on putting non-native trout, stocking non-native trout in streams who eat the frog eggs. So it's just extraordinary that when you want to do something, there is no process for permitting it. But if you want to do something terrible, you want to put in clear cut, well, they got it, you know, they got the process all down for you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another example of that, I was, and this is kind of a segue into talking about peak oil and fossil fuels. But I was at Lawrence Livermore, and I was talking to Dr. Ed Moses. I don't know if you know him, but he's the person that's the head of the whole section that's, I forgot what the initials are for it, but they're working on nuclear fusion. And they have this huge accelerator. I mean, this multi-billion dollar thing that I got to go in, and he showed me around. And he was talking about how that they're very close to a breakthrough. Now, a breakthrough in nuclear fusion means nothing more than they're going to get more energy out than they put in, and they're putting massive energy in the laser technology, massive amounts of energy, which comes, of course, from fossil fuels, into that to try to create this thing. And so he's very excited about the potential for this breakthrough in fusion. I said, well, you know, Ed, I think that's great, but if that happened, wouldn't that just speed up the destruction of the planet by increasing population and consumption, and lead to greater devastation and acceleration of the destruction of Earth if we don't change the mindset? And he couldn't get my question. He just kind of waved it off as some kind of juvenile thinking. But we're in this paradigm of working inside the system and not able to think outside of this particular system that we think inside of. And I do believe strongly that if we did find a technological solution, so there's a couple things here. One is the technological save that many people say, well, yeah, we're running out of oil, but, you know, technology is going to save us.
Well, that's, of course, the world's worst nightmare.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Thomas Berry had said many years ago, how could we be destroying the planet? We're in a technological trance, and it just seems to keep getting greater and greater. So we have a society that is totally built on fossil fuel. And I'd like you to address that in terms of what that means for the whatever we want to call the dominant culture. I know there's many ways to view it, but at the heart of it is this incredible expansion in the last 100 years, really, of a planet run on fossil fuel, which is going away.
Once again, as always, there's like five different directions I can take. Which direction do you want me to take it?
Well, I think that the key issue is that we think we'll say, let's just work with the technological one. I agree that there's at least five other aspects you could take, but let's just take, you know, the continuing escalation and, you know, around the world, people wanting to live at a standard somehow equal to the bizarre standard that we have in this, of everybody having a car and, of this technology. So.
Well, that's one of the problems, is that once this culture has destroyed, well, a couple, even from there, I gotta go a couple, three different directions. And one of them is, there's this great quote, I can't remember the guy's name right now, and I can't remember the exact quote, but he was a basically just a straight old everyday pro-state historian. And he said that the West didn't win over the world, didn't conquer the world through the power of its ideas, but instead through its ability to apply organized violence, mass organized violence. And he said the people in the West always forget that, and the people in the colonies never do.
Hmm.
And so that's one thing. You know, once you've destroyed somebody else's way of life, then, of course, I mean, once you've destroyed their connection, once you've made it so, okay, I have a friend who used to be married to somebody from Bangladesh, and even 20 years ago, his mother would say to him, so could you please go get some fish for lunch out of the stream, out of the river? But now they can no longer fish in the river because it's so polluted, and they have to get their fish from Iceland. And that's one of the things that's absolutely crucial, is denying people food security. That once you've made them dependent upon you for food, then, and by the way, going back to the beginnings of civilization, the first cities did not have walls around the outside, but they had walls around the granary. Because the point was to keep the people from getting access to the food. Because if you control people's food supply, you control them and you control them as a labor source. And so the point is, once you've made people dependent upon you for food, which means for life, then, you know, of course I would rather have access to the internet than not, you know, once they've taken away my option of living independent of the system. So that's one part. And another part is that, unfortunately, this way of life is really, really addictive. And I have to stop now and check email. And it's incredibly addictive. And in fact, it's, you know, I used to teach at a prison, and a lot of my students had been like crack or meth addicts. And they could say explicitly, you know, they would say, man, this drug cost me my family. It cost me my freedom. It has cost me, in the case of meth, it's cost me my teeth. It's cost me, you know, everything in my life, and it's cost me my freedom. And if you put some meth in front of me right now, I would take it.
Yeah.
I mean, the verb addict comes from the root meaning to enslave, because originally it comes from the same root basically as edict, that a judge would addict someone to someone else. Do you see what I'm saying?
That yeah.
If something terrible, you know, you become a big debtor or whatever it is, they decide to enslave you to your neighbor. You now become addicted through an edict. I think I'm horribly mangling that, but that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's another direction to go with this too, which is, have you read Lewis Mumford's essay, Democratic and Authoritarian Technics?
No, but I know about it.
It's great. And it's pretty interesting, because I read that in the early 90s, and then I was quoting it for years, and it ends up that I had it all wrong, because I reread it a couple of years ago. It's like, oh, my goodness, that's kind of embarrassing. But I like both definitions. Do we have a couple minutes before we have to go to break?
Yeah, we have about 10 more minutes.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah. I think this will take like 3 or 4 minutes to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's what I thought he said. Okay, he basically talks about, okay, a technic, T-E-C-H-N-I-C, is the worldview that leads to and arises from a technology. And the point about that is that a technology doesn't arrive in a vacuum, so that you can't, the Talawa did not have the social structure in place that would have caused them, or the worldview in place that would have caused them to invent a chainsaw. A chainsaw will emerge from a specific mindset. And that's not to say the Talawa didn't have technologies, but for example, they had salmon welcoming songs, which I would call a type of technology. And this culture does not have salmon welcoming songs. The point is that a certain mindset leads to a certain technology, and also then a certain mindset comes out of a technology. If you have a car, your perception of distance is much different than if you don't have a car. And so a car will change how you perceive the world. Just like, so I'm sort of beating that one to death, so that's all clear, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so that's a technic. And he said basically there are democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic, I'm first going to say how I misunderstood it for years, which I still like. It's just it's not what he meant. I don't think what he meant. A democratic technic would be one that we can do in our own community, and that does not require a large hierarchical social structure. So, for example, a bow and arrow no one can get a monopoly over it because anyone can get the materials to make it. I'm not saying it doesn't take craft or art or work, but nobody can get a monopoly on the materials. As opposed to a gun requires mining, which means it requires the whole system, the whole infrastructure surrounding mining. And even if you have a gun, there's still a monopoly on bullets. You have to have bullets. You got to have the gunpowder. Another example would be anybody can weave a grass pot. They can learn. I'm not in any way demeaning the talent that goes into it, or skill or art, but anybody can get access to reeds. On the other hand, anybody can get access to wood who doesn't live in the desert, and you can carve something from wood. On the other hand, anything requiring metal requires a larger scale infrastructure. So, for example...
Or plutonium.
Plutonium, exactly. So, nuclear power is a great example of what he would call an authoritarian technic, because yeah. It requires this authoritarian system. The same is true, by the way, for solar photovoltaics, because passive solar, anybody can face the sun. You know, anybody can do it. But on the other hand, to have a solar photovoltaic means you have to have rare earth mining, means you have to have... Yeah, once you've got the power on your house, then you... once you've got the photovoltaic on your house, you can charge a battery, whatever. But that doesn't alter the fact that you needed that larger infrastructure. So we can say all we want that we want to have a decentralized system of self-governance, but if you're going to have mining systems, if you're going to have high-speed rail, you're going to have any of that stuff, it's going to require... Anything that requires mining is going to require this authoritarian system. But it ends up that's not what he meant. When I reread it, at least now I'm still wrong, but the way I understand it now is that authoritarian techniques are more... Okay, so one of them basically, the way I understood it, is democratic techniques are ones that we can be community self-governing. Authoritarian techniques you can't. But one of the things he was saying is not merely that the authoritarians will rule over you, but I think he's actually saying... But the technic itself becomes authoritarian in that the technology gets to be in charge so that we serve the cars instead of the cars serving us, which totally makes sense with this culture, too. I mean, who are the real winners of this culture? It's the machines. They're taking over everything. And we're actually ending up serving them. You know, Elon Ilitch did some really interesting things about, you know, I stopped.
We're not serving the cars. We're serving the system and the people, the elite that have are continuing to create these things.
I think we're doing both. I'm not saying we're serving individual cars, because of course we take them to the dump, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we're serving car culture.
Car culture, yeah. Right, but even the infrastructure around that. I mean, I want to try to pull together.
The thing is, what I'm trying to get at is that there's a sense in which even the elites are not making rational decisions, because at this point they're killing the planet, which is going to kill themselves.
Yeah.
They are, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say, is that the system itself, there's a great line from 100 years ago by, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a sociologist who rationalized a lot of processes, made it so like at McDonald's, you know, all you do is flip a burger. Taylorization. Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
The guy.
Sure. Frederick Taylor.
Yeah. He said, in the past, the man was first. In this future, the system shall be first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm trying to get at with that is, yeah, of course the elites are controlling stuff, but there's a sense in which the system, they're making decisions that their priorities are the system as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're using their the system itself to feed their insatiable greed and desire for power. And I want to put this kind of in a context as we begin to go into a break here. And if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Derek Jensen. He has a new book out with the Air Keith. It's actually a book of interviews, which are, I love this new book, Derek. It just covers everything. And I'd like to get into more of the subjects in the second hour here, but it's called Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. And what a great lineup of people from that seminar that you did the interviews from. But I want to try to pull this together. So we started out talking about the dominant culture, and yes, there's many ways to address it, but you know, the fact that there's this in this system that we are caught in, that we are destroying ourselves inside of, and we seem stuck inside of the system itself. And we talked about how even the doctors in the Nazi death camps were trying to help people and do the best they could and follow the Hippocratic Oath, even inside of that system, which is much like what we're doing inside of the legal, financial systems in which we are caught in this trance. And so I'd like to begin to look at ways to break that trance.
You know, one of the things that just makes me laugh is the existence of CNN, because it's basically entertainment, and it's not, well, it's propaganda, of course, but the thing that kills me is that, and there's so many levels at which this is all so wrong. There's one level at which we can't even find out. You know, I wish there was a news station that would just have, like, that would just tell you the basics of what's going on, that there was a big, you know, there was an earthquake in some place, and, like, an hour every day, just an hour, where if somebody really wanted to, they could learn about the things that are going on in Africa. They could learn about various conflicts, just even their existence. But it's extraordinary to me that, you know, I like sports, but it just breaks my heart that people care more about, you know, the Final Four or Kobe Bryant getting injured than they do about the murder of the planet.
So you know way more about that than I do. I know that you really believe in and support in and know the value of community radio. And I'd love for you to just speak to that a little bit, Derek, about your own experience of getting the word out through community radio.
You know, I was making a joke before, but it really is true that it's, if we are to have any chance of survival at all, and if we are to have any chance of democratic self-governance, then the monopoly, the monopolization of perception has to stop. And, you know, you are frontline fighters in the war, for information and the war, your frontline resistance against the blackout of information. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I said for truth.
Yeah, for truth.
Yeah.
And you know, there's that great line by Milan Kundera, "The struggle against depression," except he makes it sexist, so I'm going to take out the sexist word. "The struggle against depression is the struggle of memory against forgetting." And what the dominant culture wants us to do, and what the news, the mainstream and the corporate news want us to do always, is forget. And they want us to get distracted. And there's a great line by Henry James' brother. What's his name? We all know his name. Anyway, God, isn't it weird? Isn't it problematical getting old?
Jesse.
We know it wasn't Jesse.
Yeah. Anyway, he said, "The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned."
Yeah.
And we see that all the time.
Say that one more time. It's a great quote.
"The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned."
And this is the very thing that we are trying to balance out. It takes, you know, we have 200 volunteers here?
At least 150 in terms of broadcasters.
Of broadcasters.
I'd like to call them citizen broadcasters.
Yeah, yeah. It's not because we're paid the big bucks at all. But, you know, I would just really like to call on our listeners to take a moment and call in. We've got people sitting at the phones. You can call in 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867 and get a copy of Derek, and Lierre also, edited this, Lierre Keith. It's really a wonderful, thought-provoking and deep look at, how our culture is destroying the planet and all life on it and what we can do about it. And I think that's one of the important things. You know, I don't look for people that come and just talk about what's wrong. I'm very often, I'm always looking for the people that actually have solutions. You know, Lester Brown, you mentioned, has been on numerous times. We had Marianne Williamson on last week. We have amazing guests, Joanna Macy and David Corton, and on and on and on, the people who are on this show to educate, inform, and support you in making thoughtful decisions that take you outside the system a little bit, so you can look with a more systems perspective of what's needed to shift the direction we're going. And as Yogi Berra says, if we continue in the direction we're going, we're liable to wind up where we're headed. Derek, I love that you make people think.
Thanks.
You know, one of the people that you interviewed in the book is someone I really like. It's Ricky Ott. And she was talking about the BP spill and going down there and doing her programs and trying to get coverage of some of these things, and how she was blocked out from really being able to take pictures of and get stories. And you've encountered that many times. Talk a little bit about the censorship that you've encountered in your own work, Derek.
Actually, is there something else? There's something else. Can I say something else?
Yeah,
first?
You can say anything you want.
Okay, great.
As long as it doesn't have four-letter words, because then they'll shut us off.
Okay, great. I would like to... Oops, likes four-letter word. I would like to to actually make a disgustingly open pitch for people to send money. And here's how it goes. That this is, and this is a true story. Okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. The big distinction is not between people who want to bring down this culture and... or people who are militants or people who aren't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And the problems we face are huge and overwhelming, and it's scary, and I don't know about you, but I despair every single day.
Yeah.
And when I was in my 20s, this is the smartest single thing I have ever done in my entire life. This is no exaggeration, the smartest thing. Oh, maybe not going into engineering was better. But anyway, we'll leave it outside. So... the smartest thing I did in my life was when I was in my mid-20s, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. At the same time, the problems are so big and so overwhelming, what can I do? And I wasn't doing anything. And so I realized, like I said, that my paying for gas at the pump was not covering the ecological and social costs of gasoline. I knew that much. So what I decided to do is that and I felt just tremendously guilty, but what do I do? So what I decided to do is for every dollar that I spent on gasoline, I would either A, give a dollar for dollar, to a local, not national, a local environmental organization, or since I didn't have any money, I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And it got me off my behind. It actually started me to doing activism. And so that's really the challenge I would like to make for people, is choose something that you find particularly heinous, whether it's if you think it's terrible that you buy groceries at, you know, not from a local place, or if you do, you know, you feel guilty if you go out to dinner or something, you know, whatever. You feel guilty when gas is a great one. You know, every time you fill up with gas, you didn't make car culture, so don't beat yourself up for it, but do something. So either A, dollar for dollar, match what you give at the pump with the donations here, or pay yourself, you know, inflation, you know, $5 an hour was okay back in 1985. So pay yourself 10 or 12 or 15 bucks an hour to do the activism yourself.
Hmm.
And if you have more money than time, then go ahead and instead of doing the activism yourself, then whenever you spend $20 on gas, send $20 to the station.
Yeah, I love that. You know, and I love the idea that every one of our listeners is an activist. You wouldn't be listening to this program if you weren't an activist. But activist has action at its root. So let's see, where should we go?
There's one more thing I want to say.
Yeah.
Which is that, and once again, I'm sorry if these are coming across as too obvious pitches, but it wasn't radio, it was books.
Mm-hmm.
But the alternative media, you know, the For me, it was Neil Everton's book, The Natural Alien, that when I was in a library when I was 26 or 27, it jumped off the bookshelf at me. And it's not too much to say that that book saved my life and saved my sanity. I read it, and it was the first book I ever read that did not take the utilitarian worldview as a given. And that book led to everything I've done. I was fortunate enough to, actually the evening after the Earth at Risk event, I had dinner among with other people with Alice Walker. And one of the things I had to say to her is I had to thank her for her essay, I think it's Am I Blue?
Yeah, something close to that, yeah.
Yeah, and because I said, had I never read that essay, I never would have written a language other than words. And the truth is that, well, there's two things. One of them is that my friend and mentor, John Osborne, always says, you know, lies are really expensive, and that's why they have to be repeated all the time. So if you can get the truth out, you know, you can break through that. If people are ready, if they're not ready, then it'll just bounce off their denial. But if they are ready, you know, if I would have read Neil Everton's book 10 years earlier, it may have meant nothing to me. But when I read it, it saved my life. And there have been times I've been listening to alternative radios where, oh, I remember being in some town in the southeast. I was on tour, and I was waiting for the instructor to show up to take me to do my event. And they had radio on, and I had never heard Norman Finkelstein before.
Hmm.
I was like, wow, I've never heard anybody say this. This is great. Andrea Dworkin did that to me. You know, there are so many. But you hear this truth, and it changes. It inoculates us against so many of the lies. And this is why I write. And this is why I'm sure you do that work too. It is absolutely crucial work in the face of this totalitarian information system.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is absolutely a joy to do this work, and it is a lot of work. I do read, like I said, the books of all the people who come on, as well as the other reading through the week, and I also have to make a living and support myself and support this show, because the people here support these shows. You know, we aren't paid. We're all volunteers here, and we're all volunteers because we really care about what's happening. And that we, and so do our listeners. You wouldn't be listening to this station if you didn't care. And I think that's a really important thing. Think about any area that you care about. You know, Andrew Harvey was on recently, and he's one of my, we have a lot of fun when we get on together, and he, you know, he loves animals. That's his big thing. And he talked about how you know, the way that animals are treated in the food system, in the scientific community, you know, all the different ways that we have treated animal, and how it broke his heart. But it broke his heart open. And when it breaks your heart open, you're called to do something. And, you know, it's the same thing that Joanna Macy continues to say, that we have to grieve for what we're losing in order to wake up and to become activists. And as Derek said, we are all activists, and it's whatever it is that breaks your heart, we're going to talk about it on this show. And you can always email me if you have a particular subject at michael@welloflight.com. Just send me an email, because I listen to what you say, and I go out and check out the things you recommend that I look at. So, Derek, let's talk. God, there's so many things I want to cover with you, and I'm trying to think of some of the you know, partly why my questions have been, you know, you can answer them in five ways, is because I really want to get, you know, into the very heart of the system in ways that we can make a difference and begin to take apart in whatever way. And I guess what I want to talk about is resistance. You know, we did an interview on Deep Green Resistance before. This book was from a resistance conference that you went to, the Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. Let's talk about how we can build a resistance movement from our own personal self outward, and the different levels that we can be participating in a resistance movement to the dominant culture. Well, and I know you can answer it 10 different ways.
First, I think something I say quite often is that the good thing about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's really great work to be done.
Yeah.
So the first step, you know, when I signed my book's Endgame, you know, Endgame is one of my books, when I signed that book for people, when I signed Volume 1, I always sign it, find what you love and defend your beloved. And there are just so many things wrong that, you know, anybody can find something that really speaks to them. I have a friend who used to run a battered women's program for the state of New York, and now she runs a battered women's shelter. And that's what she did before. She ran the battered women's program for a while. Anyway, you know, I would never say to her, you know, gosh, Charlotte, you need to work on salmon issues, because she's found her passion. And, I mean, she is so good at what she does. And, you know, there must be something that you know, I'm not talking about you, but I'm talking about you,
the listener.
Dear listener, there must be something that you love. And the chances are really good that whatever this is under assault. And the next, I guess, piece of advice, you know, I like what I said earlier about, you know, starting small and just giving yourself, you know, if you spend $20 on gas and you don't send it to the station, then pay yourself $10 an hour. That's because that's doable. I can do 2 hours in a week to start. And of course, by soon enough, I was doing it all the time. But at first, it's like, if you just tell somebody to dive in, what do? You know, it's just, you know, sort of deer in the headlights type thing. So another thing I think is really helpful, especially for young activists, is to find, this is really hard, I'm going to say, find an organization that's already doing something and work with them for a while. But it's really hard, because I know when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, a lot of my students would be really excited about doing environmental stuff. And I would tell them to go, I'd say, great, so go work at this, you know, go volunteer at this environmental organization. But the environmental organization wasn't working with them very well. And I worked with that organization a lot, so I went to talk to them and said, what's the deal? And they said, unfortunately, when people show up to do volunteer work for us, we don't know that they're going to commit to actually doing here, so we don't want to take the time to train them. And so it created sort of a double bind.
Oh, why?
And I don't know how you deal with that, like, at the station, but I just want to mention that as a significant barrier to people getting involved, is I've recommended so many people go help some organization, and then they somehow get the cold shoulder. And so I want to prepare people for that possible discouragement, and I guess say, if one organization does that to you, go to a different organization.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing.
Well,
is,
if anyone would like to work with me, I have a lot of balls in the air and do a lot of research constantly. I welcome people for an hour, for a day, or for a lifetime to participate. And that's true about many jobs here at the station. And there are many organizations around here that people can be involved in. I understand what you're saying, because I've been up against it myself, having been involved in both starting organizations and deeply involved in organizations. But there's always a place to make a difference.
And, excuse me, and yeah, I'm so glad, and that's great, that's wonderful that you do that. And the reason I was putting that barrier out there explicitly is because I know that for myself and for many other people, there is this tremendous barrier to the sort of inertia. There's a hurdle, I guess is the word. There's a hurdle to get over to actually start doing the work. But once you start doing the work and it becomes part of your life, it's really fun. And I can't imagine doing any other thing. But at first, if you can believe this, you know, with me writing all this stuff now, one of the things I started with my activism is I wrote letters to the editor, and I was so scared that I wrote them under pseudonyms. And, I mean, at this point, you know, my name's
all hard to imagine
bringing down civilization. But at first, you know, I'd say, oh, the editors were incorrect about this thing about deforestation, and I was too scared to use my own name. So I just want to validate that, too, that it can be really scary to face power at all when you first start it. When you first start, it can be tremendously scary. And so I just want to help people get over that one, too.
I have a wonderful friend who I've had on the radio here. Hopefully she's listening right now. Her name is Mary Jorgensen. Mary is 96 years old, or young, and she is still active. And I mean really active out there. But when she was in her 40s, I think, she got a call from Martin Luther King's office saying, could you come to Mississippi because we need some older folks down there. And she was one of the Freedom Riders in Mississippi. And Mary says she's been arrested so many times she's lost count. But, you know, she always went to the South dressed to the nines as a Southern lady. And they couldn't figure out what she was doing there. And because of who she was being with them, she, turned many a police and sheriff's head in a way, in a positive direction towards, she's a lifelong, she and her husband, Russ, were lifelong Quaker activists and one of my best friends and dear friend. So I just, I want to say that because she's an example to me of what a lifetime of commitment can be and inspires me every day to continue to do the work. And I know she's probably listening to this show. And Mary, thank you for all you do for the community, and thank all of you for whatever you do, whether it's, you know, being a Freedom Rider and devoting your whole life to it, or doing just writing a letter, as Derek was saying, a letter to the editor. We could use more letters to the editor about these kind of subjects in this town, quite frankly.
You know, I'll tell you something that really annoys me, which is that, well, this is both heartening and disheartening, which is, you know, I live in Northern California, and when people think about Northern California, of course, the first plant they usually think of, the first domesticated plant, is marijuana. And in California,
I was going to say redwoods.
Yeah, that's why I said domesticated plant.
Okay, domesticated.
The California has the medical marijuana laws that you can grow it for your own use and for your own medicinal use if you have a health problem, and the amount you can have is determined by the county, and the least you can have in California is 6 plants. And this is going to have a social activism point in a second. And Del Norte used to have a rule where you could have 99 plants, and the Board of Supervisors were going to reduce it to 6. And it was extraordinary because the Board of Supervisors meeting was absolutely packed. Yeah. And this is how participatory democracy is supposed to work.
Same thing here in Nevada City, by the way.
But they packed it and wouldn't let them drop it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, that's the good news, that this is how it's supposed to work. The bad news is that if they want to do something terrible about the salmon, there's only 4 people show up.
Yeah.
And so I wish people loved the salmon like they love marijuana. Hmm. And also, you know, in this county, there's only like 3 or 4 things that can get that many people out, and one of them is, and this is going to come around to our point in a second, but one of them was the medical marijuana. Another one would be off-road vehicle access. You know, the local off-road vehicle people are
right,
very strong. All sorts of right-wing stuff like that. And my point is that this is a way that the right wing has absolutely kicked our behinds, is that they have organized really well for horrible purposes often, and they started like in the 60s, started working really hard to get people on boards of education. That's why so many of those boards of education make such terrible decisions, is because they have systematically what's the word when you nourish a plant? I guess propagate. When you, they have fertilized, and
yeah.
And I'm not meaning that in terms of manure or anything. I'm thinking that in terms of they have cultivated. There's what I'm looking for. They have cultivated an activist ethos on the right that we need to cultivate as well. So that every time in this, you know, Del Norte is like basically Mississippi on the North Coast. It's just incredibly right wing, and any time there's any opinion given anywhere in the paper that doesn't conform to the right to sort of hardcore right-wing ethos, man, there's like five or six letters to the editor the next day. And I really admire their tenacity. And that's something that I wish we had more on our side. We need to really build up that ethos of doing even stuff. You know, I don't think that letters to the editor are that important on the big scale. I mean, on the big scale, what's important, of course, is that we stop the whole culture from killing the planet. But you need to help create an atmosphere where that resistance is normalized. That's one. You know, I want to go back to marijuana for a second, because one of the things that the marijuana, both medical marijuana people and then the legalization people have done, is they have done a really powerful job of organizing over the last 30 or 40 years and slowly working to make it so that what was illegal became semi-legal and then became legal. And the civil rights movement did the same thing. And the environmental movement, on the other hand, has done a pretty poor job in many ways of, I mean, we're frankly losing on every front, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, especially with the stakes being this much higher, what I'm trying to say is that even in something like the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, only 2% of the people ever picked up weapons. That's not in Ireland. That's in the IRA itself. You know, in the U.S. military, most of the people don't carry weapons around either. There's a lot of other work that needs to be done. And when you talk about the Irish resistance against the British, we have to actually go back. Well, we have to go back 800 years to 800 years of resistance, but we also have to go back to the 19th century where they had the Gaelic literature revival, where they had real pride in their literature and in their language and that, and in their sports, in their Irish traditional sports. And those movements helped create the upswell for a real resistance movement. And so I don't perceive, for example, community-supported agriculture as capital R resistant. It's not going to stop those in power from killing the planet. But I see it as an absolutely necessary adjunct to separating ourselves from the system. And the point is that I don't think separation is enough. I don't think it's enough for us to simply withdraw from the system. That wouldn't have worked with the Nazis, and it won't work with the capitalists, and it wouldn't have worked with the Soviets. You know, it doesn't matter.
But it's part of an important concerted effort with other roles that need to be played in addition to bring some of the structures down.
Yes, absolutely. And it's so funny because over the years, especially right after Endgame came out, there were some there was some permaculture activists who got really mad at me for talking about the necessity of resistance. And the thing that was funny is the same time that some of the, especially newbies, you know, people who are just really excited about permaculture, they just learned about it, they'd send me some really nasty notes. But what they didn't know at the same time is that some of the sort of bigwigs in the permaculture movement were writing to me going, oh, yes, this is so great, because we're, you know, one of us is the left arm and one of us is the right arm, you know, and we have to move together in those, we have to learn how to work together in the various parts of our resistance with the goal. See, here's the deal, is if the Irish would have written these wonderful plays just because they want to have beautiful Gaelic plays and beautiful Gaelic songs, that's not part of a resistance. But if you have those songs with an intentional conscious goal of making this culture that makes it so resistance is feasible, it's like, that's why I go back to, that's why I was bringing up the marijuana thing, is that they worked really hard, and I'm not commenting on, I mean, I use marijuana for Crohn's disease. I'll just go ahead and be explicit about that. But I'm not actually a druggie, you know? It's so funny because I'm a medical marijuana advocate, but never in my life have I ever taken any recreational drug. I don't even drink coffee. But the point is that they have worked very hard. I'm saying it as a model of working very hard to create a culture where it was even possible to get medical marijuana laws passed. I think that's extraordinary work, and we need to think the same way. It's like Thomas Lindsay. He's one of the people we interview in the book. One of the things he's doing, he's so great.
It's a great interview, by the way, with Thomas, and I've interviewed him before, but I loved your interview in the book.
Oh, thanks. And I just have to mention, you're very, very gracious, and you're a wonderful interviewer.
Thank you.
So one of the things that Thomas says, or I'll say what Thomas has done. One of the things he's done is he really believes in community self-governance. And so there's a lot of townships in Pennsylvania, for example, that passed regulations against corporate hog farms being in their township, in their county. Or more recently, Pittsburgh passed a law banning fracking within the city limits, which is just extraordinary that a city actually has to pass a law banning the poisoning of the groundwater within the city. It's just stunning. And so he does this all over. And part of his thing is he thinks, for example, that the regulatory approach to environmentalism has been a failure, because we shouldn't be regulating these things, but instead we should be not allowing them in the first place, mm-hmm. and communities should be determining their own economic and ecological fate. And why did I bring that up? Oh, because I brought that up because that is part of a resistance too.
Right. Along with permaculture, organic, or sustainable agriculture, along with transition towns, all of these things. And then there's also a level that
as well as physically stopping perpetrators.
Right. Yeah. And I don't want to get too far into that. There is a question of, that people, of course, always ask, what about violence? But I want to talk about that in a different way, mm-hmm. and we can get back to that. I want to talk about the violence against women. And, this is, as you know, I work with Satyana Organization on healing wounds between men and women, one of the other things that I'm involved in, and have had many people on this show talking about this issue. I want to talk about the relationship of objectification, pornography, and violence and rape of women and the rape of the earth, the relationship there. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. About a year and a half ago, I wrote one of the best things I've ever written, which was called The Man Box. And I became acquainted with Eve Ensler. We become friends. And she wanted me to write this for her. And what she wanted to write is sort of an equivalent of Vagina Monologues, but something about men and about leaving the man box. And so I ended up writing this thing, and maybe 8 or 10 pages, and people can look it up on the internet, The Man Box. It's one of my favorite things I've ever written. And basically what it is I decided that the man box is not really about men being put in a box, but within patriarchy has at its core a violation imperative. And this imperative has to do with, you have to define someone else as inferior and therefore violable, and then you need to violate them in order to validate your superiority, and thus violation becomes not only something you do, but your very identity. And so women need to be defined as inferior and therefore violable. People of different races need to be defined as inferior and therefore violable. And non-humans need to be defined as inferior and therefore violable. And then every time you violate them, once again, you're validating your own superiority. And there are a bunch of problems with this, one of which, of course, is that it's really nasty. Another problem with this is that because there is always someone else, that means that you're never done violating, because there's always someone else to violate. And another problem with this is there's a great line by R.D. Lang, which is, how do you plug a void plugging a void? And what he means by that is, if you have an inner void and you attempt to plug it using something that doesn't work to plug it, you have to keep doing it again and again. And so this is true if you, if a man is feeling existentially lonely and depressed, and to stop the depression and loneliness, he A, watches television, or B, rapes a woman. In either case, and I'm not saying that watching television is bad as raping a woman, what I'm saying is, in either case, he's attempting to plug that void with a void, and it won't work. And so it has to keep going. And this helped me when I wrote this, and that's, of course, one reason we write, is to help ourselves understand stuff. And when I wrote this, I finally understood why, for example, they had to bomb the moon, why they have to probe the deepest folds of the ocean. There was this, just recently, they drilled into this lake in the, and some, some, some sub-ice lake in Antarctica that has been separated from the atmosphere for 2 million years or something like that. I don't know, a long, long time. And they were afraid that they would contaminate it, but they did it anyway. They had to drill into this lake. It's they have to boldly go where no man has gone before. That's part, that's central to the violation imperative. And so that's one of the places where my work all revolves around that intersection of violence against women, violence against indigenous peoples, violence against non-humans. What are the things that hold those together? And one of the things that holds that together is this violation imperative that's created in part when, I mean, it's created through social training, and it's created in part through also, I mean, obviously children are separated from their, it's created through our child-rearing practices, including abuse. It's created through just a constant flow of information suggesting that
Well, it objectifies women. It suggests that that the patriarchy is somehow that the women are subservient to that. I loved your interview with Gail Dines.
Oh, she's fabulous.
She's amazing. And if you don't know her, she's an anti-pornography campaigner. She is a sociology professor at is it Wheelock College in Boston,
yeah.
I think. And her work is around how the images of pornography have shifted from the early days of Playboy to these really violent images that have also bled into the pop culture and become acceptable and mainstream. When you look at the posters and the poses, I've done a study, there's many films about this that you can get online. I'm trying to think of the one that I most like, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but this has had a huge impact on the increase, and it is about filling the void, but it's also a void is created by objectifying women, and through pornography, they're constantly getting extreme, you know, like extreme skiing or snowboarding or these kinds of things. There's extreme sexing happened where there's horrible images through the internet that then bleed into the pop culture where it becomes in order for someone to get sexual pleasure, they have to have very deviant, extreme, painful, violent actions taken. And there is a direct correlation to how we treat the natural environment.
Well, a couple of things. Yes, I completely agree. And a couple of things about that. One of them is that another being, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about a lover or a friend or a relative or a mountain lion or a tree or a rock, whatever, whomever, that other being is infinitely complex. And if you're in relationship with someone, even if you've known them forever, you can still learn things about them. But if you're attempting to interact with an object or one you are perceiving as an object because you are to use Martin Buber's language, you're not in an I-you relationship, but an I-it relationship with them, then you're not getting that continual stimulation of something new because a person of any sort is infinitely complex. And if you're interacting with an object, then in order to maintain the stimulation, you have to increase that stimulation to make up for what is missing emotionally. And you know, where I first learned that was reading Randy Schilt's very interesting book, And the Band Played On, about the early AIDS crisis. Mm. And in there, at one point, he's talking about the whole bathhouse scene from the early 1980s. And one of the things he asked is how they could get to, how they could move into this area where they would end up, and I'm not going to use any letters or words are going to get in trouble, but you know, anal, putting your hands up somebody's behind, putting your fist up somebody's behind, how you could get to that stage with someone you don't even know. And he realized that when you don't have the emotional stimulation of some sort of relationship, that physical stimulation has to take its place. In other words, or to keep it from getting boring. And I think that that applies all around to all this other stuff too, that you have to, if you're not satisfied with a fundamental, and see, here's the deal too, this also applies to this whole culture from the beginning, because the culture has been a culture of expansion from the beginning. Once again, the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years. That's three or four times as long as this civilization has been conquering the planet. And they spent all that time hanging out here, and they were, from what I've read and from what I've heard, they were relatively satisfied with their lives. They didn't have to. There's this great line by Eric Fromm, I affect, therefore I am.
Yeah.
And if you are not feeling effective in your own life, and if you're not filled with relationships, you have to affect some other. And this is one reason they build dams. This is one reason that they're for all the rapes. This is one reason for all of this, is that they, and that's one thing I wanted to say. And then the other thing I wanted to say is the process of pornographying the entire culture has been precisely analogous to what I was talking about how, you know, marijuana became more accepted within the culture. It's the exact same. It goes back to the, Doobie Brothers album, What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits, that, you know, one of the most unforgivable books of the 20th century, I believe, is Lolita. I find Lolita more offensive in many ways than a lot of hardcore pornography, because one of the things it did is legitimize pedophilia. I love what Judith Herman says about it, that it's one of the most beautifully written apologies for child rape.
Yeah.
And so my point is that there are, and I always used to say, and I say this with some of my fellow, you know, some of my friends who are anti-pornography activists, I say this to them too, that in some ways I hate all those old James Bond movies even more than I hate porn, because they were mainstreaming a lot of the images. It all works of a piece. It's just like a resistance movement. Part of a resistance movement is above ground and part's below ground. And it was kind of the same with pornography, that the mainstream, the objectification of women became more and more overt and it changed form. Obviously, there was tremendous objectification in the 1930s and 1940s. I'm not saying there wasn't, obviously. But in terms of pornography becoming more overt and more accepted, there was work done on that above ground and below ground.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other topic.
Right, and we're getting close to the end. Derek, you're a historian, one of the many things that you've dabbled in and I would say have a good grasp of. Why do you say that you consider civilization the very foundation of domination and the beginning of this system of environmental apartheid, actually?
Well, it's like I said about there being no surplus in nature, that every civilization has been based upon destroying its land base. And, you know, how many minutes do we have?
We have about 6 minutes, okay. Basically.
Great. So, in that case, I'll tell a little bit longer story. So,
okay.
Another essay I'm going to write for Orion soon, is going to be another one of the next two, is going to be about how every evening one of the chores I do at my mom's house is I carry in firewood for her to burn the next day. And every time I do that, I pick up the piece of wood and I blow off spiders and I blow them back into the rest of the wood pile. And by the way, there are a lot fewer spiders and sow bugs. There's almost no sow bugs anymore here. I don't know why. And that's very bad. Anyway, but every time I do this, I recognize that I'm just pushing them into a smaller and smaller area, and I'm just putting off the inevitable because I'm destroying the habitat of those particular spiders. This is a microcosm of what's going on a large scale. And so what I'm going to say in the essay after that is one of the reasons I'm against civilization is not because I don't like hot showers. I like hot showers as much as the next person. And one of the reasons I'm against it, though, is because I can do math. You know, I can do simple subtraction. And I recognize that there used to be what, 7 billion passenger pigeons on this continent, and then there were 6 billion, and then 5 billion, and now there's none. And there used to be salmon so thick that that Indians would, one of the things they would do for fun is they would throw a little stone in the water, and then they would count how long it would take to get to the bottom because there were so many fish that the stone couldn't fit between them. And there were so many whales off the New England coast that it looked like fog a lot of the time. There were fish so thick that they were impediment to shipping. And it's gone. And I can see trends. I can see. I mean, when it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if 99% of the native forests have been converted, that that's a pattern. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out. And so, you know, and indigenous languages are being destroyed even more quickly, at a relatively quicker rate than indigenous beings, than native species. And that's one of the things we didn't really get into today, but it's extraordinary to me that people can't see that pattern. And yes, we get access to ice cream 24/7. And that's one of the reasons that we defend this system. That's one of the reasons that we can't. Remember the line about it's hard to make a person understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it?
Yep.
The Talawa didn't have access to ice cream, you know? And I hate to think that we will allow the world to be killed because we get access to ice cream and television and email.
Mm.
But the truth is, I mean, once again, I like ice cream. And that doesn't alter the fact that I can see that the production of ice cream is not sustainable. That doesn't mean that me not eating ice cream is going to stop the culture. I'm not saying that we need to be personally pure. What I'm saying is that we need to recognize these patterns. And then the task of an activist, and this is one of Lear's great lines, I love this line, the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority.
Hmm.
And so civilization comes in because one of the reasons that we're gaining, one of the reasons that we have this fabulously extravagant, there's the word I'm looking for, extravagant way of life is because we're living inside a giant gated community with the United States military as the gatekeepers.
Boy, isn't that the truth.
And we are gaining. The thing is, let's go back to the economic statement. There is no free lunch and there is no free email. You know? My computer takes tremendous amounts of water. And here's an important thing, too. They always say the world's running out of water. And there are lots of rivers. Half of the rivers in China are dewatered. They did a survey the other day that in the last 50 years, from maps that were 50 years ago, half of the rivers there are no longer have water in them. And 90%, more than 90% of the water used by humans is not actually used to drink or take showers or anything. It's used for agriculture and industry. And fracking uses a lot of water. Making computers uses a lot of water.
I can hear our listeners out there saying, well, Derek, what can I do about this?
Actually, I'm going to undercut everything I've said the whole program.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, and you know, I've made these overt pitches to people, and I'm glad to make another overt pitch that people need to support, you know, large organizations. I mean, Fox News has money coming out their ears, you know, and we're fighting them on shoestrings on every level. So yes, absolutely, people need to support community-supported radio and other small community organizations. And then in addition to that, I want to challenge people to not merely support through giving money, but giving themselves to what they believe in, to find what you love and then defend your beloved, because we can't rely on your radio station or my books or DGR or Thomas Lindsay or anything else to save us. We can't have that sort of heroic narrative. What we need is people finding what they love and then digging in and working really, really hard to, I mean, if what you love is local lizards, find out what's going on with local lizards and help them.
Yeah.
Do that in addition to supporting the radio station. In addition, don't just use your checkbook, but use your heart and your time as well.
Yeah, we're going to have to call it a wrap at that. And I'm so grateful, Derek, for your taking the time, a two-hour special here on KVMR. And I know our listeners greatly appreciate it. We'll talk soon, Derek. Thank you so much for your support. Take care.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 Nevada City and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.